Well, it's that time again. You can always tell the Wendell study leave when it starts by the strange announcements in the bulletin, as Nate gets really creative at this time. The study leave is, I think, a very important thing for Wendell. You know, a lot of pastors have that problem of the daily chores of the church, and then they also have the push to put out a new sermon or a new message every week, something fresh and something interesting about the text, and that is quite a burden to put up with. And this gives him a chance to spend some time in study and exploring the Word of God on his own, so that when he comes back, he'll have some enriched understanding of the text and be able to be a little more relaxed at working with the textual material. If we can ever use the term relaxed about Wendell. Last year and this year both, he gave me a list of passages, you may remember from last year, that are either difficult, have apparent conflicts, or that sometimes they're unclear and there's disagreement as to how to interpret them. I think that's because he likes to see me sort of struggle up here. In the terms of the old-time ministers, texts like this don't preach in the sense that they're not exhortive, they're not inspirational, they're explanatory, and therefore leaves sort of a flat ending to a text. But then again, I tend to have flat endings anyway, so it won't be too unexpected. My daughter Megan suggested that I should come up here and do about a 30-second to 1-minute sermon for the tape for Wendell, so that when it was sent to him, he would have me just simply give the conclusion and then sit down. I don't know why it is. It's so fun to tease Wendell when you get the opportunity. But today we're looking at a passage in 1 Samuel, the famous passage of the Witch of Endor. And this is a passage that's been widely discussed over the centuries, both within Judaism in the ancient and modern sense, and also Christianity itself. And we will look at it as an exercise in hermeneutics, an attempt to look at some of the variants in the text and suggest some directions. Hermeneutics is apparently of interest to the rest of my family as well, as my granddaughter Katie the other day was talking to her mom and said, when you and your sister Megan get together, I know why Megan's always the boss. Because in Sunday school we talked about Jacob and Esau and that the older shall serve the younger. Hopefully she'll get in Hermeneutics 101 when the time comes. Let's take a look at the text. It's in 1 Samuel 28, verses 3 through 19. 1 Samuel 28, verses 3 through 19. Now Samuel was dead, and all Israel had mourned for him and buried him in his own town of Ramah. Saul had expelled the mediums and the spiritists from the land. The Philistines assembled and came and set up camp at Shunem, while Saul gathered all Israel and set up camp at Gilboa. When Saul saw the Philistine army, he was afraid. Terror filled his heart. He inquired of the Lord, but the Lord did not answer him by dreams or Urim or prophets. Saul then said to his attendants, "Find me a woman who is a medium, so I may go and inquire of her." "There is one in Endor," they said. So Saul disguised himself, putting on other clothes, and at night he and two men went to the woman. "Consult a spirit for me," he said, "and bring up for me the one that I name." But the woman said to him, "Surely you know what Saul has done. He has cut off the mediums and the spiritists from the land. Why have you set a trap for me, for my life, to bring about my death?" Saul swore to her by the Lord, "As surely as the Lord lives, you will not be punished for this." Then the woman asked, "Whom shall I bring up for you?" "Bring up Samuel," he said. When the woman saw Samuel, she cried out at the top of her voice and said to Saul, "Why have you deceived me? You are Saul." The king said to her, "Don't be afraid. What do you see?" The woman said, "I see a ghostly figure coming up out of the earth." "What does he look like?" he asked. "An old man wearing a robe is coming up," she replied. Then Saul knew it was Samuel, and he bowed down and prostrated himself with his face to the ground. Samuel said to Saul, "Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?" "I am in great distress, Saul said. "The Philistines are fighting against me, and God has departed from me. He no longer answers me, either by prophets or by dreams. So I have called on you to tell me what to do." Samuel said, "Why do you consult me now that the Lord has departed from you and become your enemy? The Lord has done what he predicted through me. The Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hands and given it to one of your neighbors, to David. Because you did not obey the Lord or carry out his fierce wrath against the Amalekites, the Lord has done this to you today. The Lord will deliver both Israel and you into the hands of the Philistines, and tomorrow you and your sons will be with me. The Lord also give the army of Israel into the hands of the Philistines." It's an interesting passage, and as I say, it's engendered a lot of discussion over the years. When you think about the historical context here, sometime earlier, Samuel had pronounced judgment on Saul and had relayed the message that God had rejected Saul in judgment for his actions and his refusal to obey the commands related to the Amalekites. In the intervening time between that and this incident, Samuel has died. And Saul is about to be attacked by a large group of Philistines in a battle that's going to take place shortly at Gilboa, or near Gilboa. Saul has lost the voice of Samuel. He has no access to the priestly ephod because that went with the priest who left and went to David's side. His inquiries produced no responses through dreams, other prophets, or other traditional methods of seeking the Lord's guidance. So even though he has outlawed all mediums in the land, he now decides it's time for him to contact one. And so he tells his assistants to find a medium for him. And it's hard to tell in the text, but it appears like they already knew. I mean, there's an instant sort of, "Oh, we know there's one out at Endor." And so he decides to head to Endor to consult this medium about what to do. He disguises himself because he's going to go either near or even behind the enemy lines. So he doesn't want to be recognized. In addition, he may not want the medium to recognize him as the king. And with his two assistants, then he makes his way through the dangerous countryside to Endor, where he visits this medium. And he does this, of course, at night as well. So again, he will avoid detection. When he gets there, he requests that the medium bring up any person that he's going to name. He hasn't named anybody yet, but he is seeing if she's willing to do that. She, of course, is fearing a trap. Spiritism has been outlawed in the nation, and she's afraid that it's just a way of sort of entrapment, getting her to make some sort of action that will get her arrested and executed. And in response to that, Saul swears by the life of Yahweh. He swears on the life of God that she's not going to be persecuted or prosecuted for this action. Interesting, of course, since he has been rejected by Yahweh and is now seeking out something that Yahweh has forbidden, that he would invoke Yahweh's name at that point. Verse 12 has Samuel coming before the medium, and at that point, the medium recognizing that it's Saul before her. whether it's because of the fact that it actually is Samuel, and therefore there's some indication of his appearance that it really is Saul that's doing it, or whether it's because he invoked the name of God and said he could guarantee that she wouldn't be prosecuted, which would indicate he had the power in the land to override the king's edict at that point. It's interesting, in the Septuagint, verse 12, actually says, when the medium saw Saul. So the idea in that text would be that she actually recognized in his request who he was. But we'll talk about that a little later on. Notice in the text that Saul himself doesn't see Samuel. He asks the medium what she sees, and she describes, not in detail, but describes Samuel by his garb, his prophet's robe, and the fact that he is coming upright. And the medium actually says at that point, I see Elohim, I see gods, or God, a God, coming up from the earth, which is an interesting expression under the circumstances. And of course, Samuel responds by reiterating that judgment is on its way, and that because of his utter disregard for what God had instructed him over his career as king, he was being judged. You may remember, since Samuel anointed him, it was almost a constant battle between Samuel and Saul. Every time he turns around, he's either only partially doing what he's told to do or not doing things at all. And Samuel actually has split with him over his treatment of the Amalekites and pronounced judgment, and they really don't interact anymore after that time until this point here. In terms of the theological context, the reason why this has been so much discussed is that this wide divergence of opinion is about what actually is going on here. And generally, it deals with the issue of the life after death, the spirit world, and whether the Bible here is ratifying the power of mediums, even though the action is forbidden. Is it saying they actually do contact the dead? There have been a lot of explanations. There's been no lack of opinions from ancient times to the present. Divergent positions, as I said, were held in Judaism and Christianity from the earliest time to the present. And it's actually startling to see not only how early, but how widely this discussion ranged in the ancient world. As one commentator has put it on this, although the general tendency of this narrative is clear enough, it contains many difficulties, and when read from a more logical point of view, some of these are even impossible to solve. Therefore, this pericope gave expounders of every age much trouble, but especially those from antiquity, when biblical exegesis was more strictly determined by dogmatic and logical determinations. In other words, your dogmatic assumptions usually determined where you came out on what is going on in this text. We get an early glimpse of how ancient Judaism dealt with this passage, not from a Jewish writer, but from a Christian writer. In the early 4th century, there was a Christian by the name of Pionius, who was condemned to die during the persecution of Decius. Prior to his martyrdom, there are accounts of speeches he gave, both in defense of his Christian faith and explanation of it. And in one of these recording speeches, he talks about the Jews' belief in his day that the resurrection was necromancy. It was magic that brought Jesus back to life, not vindication by God of Jesus' message and a true miracle. It was just magic. And they pointed here to the story of Endor, just as the mediums used their craft to to raise Samuel, so the early Christians employed magic to make it appear that Jesus was resurrected. And so Pionius's refutation was to argue that Samuel didn't actually appear in this incident, that it was a demon appearing as Samuel. When you look at biblical material, of course, there's only one other reference in the Bible to this incident, and that's found in Chronicles, in Chronicles 10, 1 Chronicles 10, 13 through 14, which is a brief summary, a recounting of the chronicler. It says, Saul died because he was unfaithful to the Lord. He did not keep the word of the Lord, and he even consulted a medium for guidance, and did not inquire of the Lord. So the Lord put him to death and turned the kingdom over to David, son of Jesse. And again, there's a variant reading in the Septuagint that puts a phrase in the end of 13, verse 13 there, that says, And Samuel the prophet answered him. So it says he consulted a medium for guidance, and Samuel the prophet answered him. Apparently they're trying to make it clear that it was actually Samuel that appeared. There's also a reference to this passage in the Intertestament work, Ecclesiasticus, but it offers little help because its only reference is that Saul was a great prophet. He even prophesied after he was dead, and therefore he's being commended for his prophetic utterance, and that it didn't stop at death. He just kept going. not a whole lot of help in determining it. Some early rabbis held to essentially what Paionios reported them as saying. Namely, that the woman at Endor did go through her mediumistic powers and by her magic was able to bring back Samuel. Although they believed, as the Bible, that this whole process was condemned, they still believe it actually worked, that it was efficacious when it came to being able to do it. It just was a forbidden activity. And oftentimes then they, of course, were very vague about how that process would actually occur. There's a famous passage in one of the rabbinic writings that says, and she did what she did and said what she said and raised him. In other words, we don't know what happened, but she did her thing and he came up. Sounds typically Jewish there. She did what she did and said what she said. Another early group of Jewish writers believe that Samuel rose at the command of the Creator. And his appearance astonished the woman, who was generally a fake, and her reaction, screaming and talking loudly, was related to the fact that she hadn't expected Samuel to appear, and she was startled by it, terrified, in fact. Just dawned on me, I don't have the wireless microphone on. Are you getting me okay? Okay. So no dead person was raised, and no demon appeared. Another view, which is Rabbi Samuel ben Hofni, who somewhat later, this is about 1084, argued that no dead person was raised, no demon appeared, and the medium faked the whole thing. She recognized who Saul was from his appearance. You've got to remember, Saul was head and shoulders above anyone in the entire nation. He was a very, very tall guy. He was easily recognizable. And the fact that he was seeking out information from Samuel also would have been an indicator, as was his insistence that she couldn't possibly be punished for doing this task. So she recognized Saul and deduced the rest from commonly known information. It was clear from chapters earlier in Samuel that judgment was pronounced on Saul, and that he was under the judgment of God, and that the kingdom had been given to David. In terms of ancient Christian treatments, the spectrum is pretty much the same. In a survey of the early church fathers up until approximately 800 AD, Dr. Smelik surveys all the positions and catalogs them into three broad categories. The first category was church fathers such as Justin Martyr, Origen, Ambrose, Augustine, and others who held that Samuel was resuscitated by the forbidden powers of the woman. In other words, the text is pretty much read in its plainest sense, that the woman did what she did, in the Jewish expression again, and raised Samuel up, and he was able then to give the message. It's not endorsing the mediumistic practice, but it is saying that it actually works. Group two argued that either Samuel or a demon in a shape appeared not through the powers of the woman, but at God's command. So that this was a special occurrence. The medium was doing whatever she did, and she was surprised because God actually allowed Samuel to come back and present his message. This category would include such stalwarts as John Chrysostom, Theodoret of Cyrus, and others. And a third group held that Saul was deceived by a demon who gave a forged prophecy. In this group would be Pionius, Tertullian, Gregory of Nyssa, Jerome, and many others. And so you have, again, that same sort of range in here. And there are a few others that are sort of minority voices. There's one Christian father who argues that what happens here is that the medium is actually able to enchant Saul, and he thinks he's talking to Samuel, but that the whole thing takes place in his head. Interesting for an ancient view. It seems like that would be a more modern view. When you move up to the Reformation, it's interesting that in the Reformation, all the magisterial Protestant reformers and all their followers for the next 100 years were almost totally unanimous in holding that Satan or a demon played the role of Samuel and deceived Saul into believing it was real. It wasn't really Samuel that appeared, but a demonic power imitating Samuel. And I think this also reflects the debate between the Catholics and Protestants, because, of course, the Reformers had an aversion to believing in a spirit's ability to appear in the afterlife. One of the big arguments was over the state of the dead in the afterlife. And with the Catholic doctrine of purgatory, you have the possibility of spirits being around for a time. Indeed, a very interesting book I read a number of years ago called The Cultural History of Ghosts presents the fact that Catholics on a whole believe in ghostly appearances and spirits, whereas Protestants don't, because Protestants think when you die you go to be with the Lord or you go to the place of the dead and remain there, and that you don't come back. In fact, if you look at the two most known written descriptions of ghosts among Protestant material, it's the John Wesley and then J.B. Phillips, the one that our speaker at Reason for Hope talked about. It's interesting that they both come from that Anglo-Catholic tradition, which allows for purgatory. Interesting observation. And of course, in America, we think of modern spiritualism, which is not exactly the same thing. Modern spiritualism in the Western culture started in 1848 with the Fox sisters, two little girls that were actually playing a prank on their mother. They put a needle and a thread through an apple and then tied it to their toe, and when they were in bed, they would bounce it off the floor, the wooden floor in the cabin, and that would make raps, so they would hear noises. And eventually they made a system for, you know, if this power that's producing these raps wants to say yes, it would be so many raps, no, it would be so many raps, or they could go through the alphabet and the supposed spirit would rap at a particular letter. That started an absolute avalanche of spiritualist practice in the Western culture that hadn't been around in any meaningful way before that time. And it's really difficult to imagine how popular in the 19th century this practice was. In a small country, scattered settlers, it was interesting that adherents and people interested in those spiritualist sessions went into the millions. It was a very popular movement in the 19th century. Kings across the globe had seances in their palaces. Presidents here in the United States had seances in the White House, including Abraham Lincoln, whose wife was an avid spiritualist. And it was interesting that by the time the Fox sisters actually confessed to the prank nature of the start of the movement had taken such a direction of its own that nobody paid any attention. Katie Fox got on stage in 1888 in New York and actually not only confessed, but she demonstrated how they were able eventually to make raps by snapping their toes against a piece of wood, and that would make the loud rap. But nobody paid the slightest bit of attention to it because the movement had taken on a head of its own at that point. But from that start in fraud, it's clear that modern spiritualism has been involved in fraud from the very beginning. And if you read the books written critical of the spiritualist movement, it's interesting how the process was that the mediums would come up with a new trick, they would be exposed, they would come up with another trick, they'd be exposed, and just happened over and over again. Instead of rejecting the belief, people still believed that the spiritualism was true. Well, when you look at it, it seems to be there's a limited number of options that are realistically possible. And the first one is that sort of a straightforward reading of the text describes Samuel is actually speaking to Saul, and therefore we should take it at face value, that Samuel, through this intermediary, actually spoke with Saul. And, of course, early treatments such as the Septuagint additions to Chronicles and people like the ancient Jewish historian Josephus tend to hold to this sort of position. And it does have the positive effect that it lets you read it in sort of a natural sense. On the negative side, it seems to put the righteous Samuel under the authority of a prescribed medium. The medium demands he comes up, and he comes up. So you have the prophet of God who has to obey the incantations of this evil medium. And that doesn't seem to be quite realistic. God had departed from Saul, and he wasn't communicating with him, and yet he comes back and communicates one last time through Samuel to this medium. No other passage in the Bible supports the idea of a medium being able to raise the dead. It just condemns the practice because it leads people into seeking guidance apart from God, and also was a practice of all the surrounding nations that were evil and condemned by Scripture. There are passages in the Bible also that indicate the dead don't return. Remember the story in the New Testament of, individual who wants to come back and give a warning, and even in that case, they're not allowed. And then you have the surprise of the medium. You know, the fact that she reacts in almost terror and surprise that this being appears. It doesn't appear that she was expecting her powers to actually conjure up some individual. A second possibility is that of a medium raising a demonic imitator, and that, of course, was again the Protestant position in the first 100 years of Protestantism. And it avoids, its positives are it avoids God's seeming verification of the power of mediums. It doesn't give necessarily any credence to that. In terms of conjuring up real spirits, particularly of righteous prophets like Samuel. And in the text, it's interesting that Saul does not appear to see Samuel. It's based on a vague description that the medium gives. And this position also would preserve the finality of death until the resurrection. Cons, it would make the narrative to speak phenomenological. What do we mean by phenomenological? How it appears. We talk about phenomenological language in terms of when the Bible says the sun rises and the sun sets, it's not meaning literally that the sun is revolving around the earth. It's simply speaking the way we speak today in a way it appears to us to be, not making any sort of final declaration about cosmology. Here it would say, in that context, Saul thought he was talking to Samuel, and so it's narrated in that sense. So it's possible, and certainly there have been strong advocates of that, including many fundamentalists who hold that, but it does present a little bit of a difficulty. A final position that's become popular in modern times is that the medium just faked the whole thing. And the idea here is that she knew, again, from the appearance of Saul, that he was the king. She knew that Samuel had rejected him in the name of God and that he was about to be judged. And therefore, she pretended she saw Samuel and related that message. And then the final position is that God worked a special appearance. That in this case, God, who has the power to do whatever is consistent with his character, allowed Samuel to come and make this appearance. And that, again, helps you read the text with some certain sense of straightforwardness. But you do have sort of a subtle endorsement of the power of a medium by having it appear that the medium really is doing something even though she isn't. And therefore it becomes a little deceptive in what it's teaching. Well, about all those options, no one has made a clear-cut knockout. And if you read commentaries, you'll see that there's usually one or two positions at least discussed. The fact is that there's not a lot of information given in the text. And so one of the things we have to do in terms of hermeneutics is try not to go beyond what the text says. You know, the story is given without comment editorially. My personal belief is that it probably is the latter, that God worked a special appearance and it was Samuel. Although my natural inclination as a skeptic is to argue that as mediums fake it today, she was faking it back then and the whole thing was a deception. The thing that keeps me from doing that is the actual reference to Samuel said to Saul, which would imply that there really is something going on there. And again, it could be phenomenological language, but there's no reason to jump to that conclusion without stronger reasons. Remember in hermeneutics that we read in the natural sense of the text unless there's something in the text that forces us to believe otherwise. So with a nebulous conclusion, you've got a right to ask, so what? I mean, what's the big deal here? But in fact, the passage is not there to tell us things about mediums or the spirit world. It's to portray the depth at which Saul has sunk. That Saul has repeatedly disobeyed God and not been faithful to his calling. Having been given the calling of being king, he was certainly elevated to a high position, but he tended to fail at every turn of the road, and God provided judgment for that reason. And you actually have to feel sorry for the despair that's in this passage. You know, Saul, who has been given all sorts of instruction along the way from God, even though he hasn't obeyed it, now has been rejected by God. He's not hearing anything. In his desperation, he's looking desperately for some word here, and God has turned his back on Saul. And so it's a reminder in this passage of guarding our own lives and calling before Jesus Christ, that we should be faithful and that we should not take for granted our relationship with him. It's also a reminder for us in our culture that's embarrassingly enamored of occult practices, all the shows about mediums on TV, all the best-selling books by mediums. I come across Christians all the time that don't appear to be aware of the fact that all of this is forbidden in Scripture, that it's cursed as a practice. They just seem to embrace it. You know, when I used to be in the book business, we'd have people come in and get all the Left Behind series and then about 10 New Age books of various kinds to go along with it. They didn't see a problem with that because the church isn't properly instructing people about the teachings on these matters. And therefore, it's a reminder of, again, that forbidden activity. And then finally, of course, it's helpful in terms of hermeneutics. We can understand that we can agree on detail, or we can disagree on what the details in a particular passage may say because there's not enough information there to decide. But on the other hand, you still have the clear message of what the passage is saying. The passage isn't all about the discussions that we just had. Those are sidelines. And what you decide on those will probably depend on what you think about those matters elsewhere in Scripture, not necessarily on the passage itself. But the passage on itself is a stark reminder, again, of the danger of not being faithful and turning our back on God's instructions and seeking our own way and then the judgment that comes as a consequence to that.